You're listening to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, and this is going to be me steering solo today, unfortunately, without my lovely co-host, Katie, who finds herself on the other side of the planet. Katie will be back, though, and we will be back to our regular programming. But in Katie's absence, I'm really delighted today to have on the show somebody that you may have read a few years ago, at least, on The Diplomat, Casey Michelle, who started writing for us. How long ago, Casey, was it that you started writing for The Diplomat?
Oh, it was about 1,000 years ago, if I remember correctly. No, sometime in the mid-2010s, 2015, 2016, thereabouts.
Yeah, you know, Casey was one of our original Central Asia writers. But since then, Casey has gone on to do quite a bit more. And I'm actually glad to have him on the show today to talk about his new book, which has been getting great reviews. The book is called Foreign Agents, with a great subtitle, How American Lobbyists and Lawmakers Threaten Democracy Around the World. So, Casey, congratulations on the book. Really happy to have you on the show to dig in a little bit to the murky world of foreign agents here in the United States, but also how foreign governments seek to influence American politics to further advance their goals. But, you know, this is a podcast about geopolitics fundamentally. And, you know, we talk a lot on this podcast about the kind of the units of analysis that you have to consider when you think about the ways in which the world works, right? People talk a lot about, obviously, what governments do, what militaries do, intelligence agencies do. But I think the story of what your book is about is really about the ways in which governments reach into each other's societies and seek to really influence the flows of cash, the flows of legislation, so on and so forth. So explain to our listeners a little bit, you know, why should people care about foreign agents? And what exactly is this world that your book is about?
Yeah, sure, Ankit. Obviously, deeply grateful to be here with you today. I know you and I were just talking off mic about how far we've come from our first days writing for the Diplomat all those years ago, and it has been remarkable to watch your career blossom as well. And I can't tell you what an honor it is to be back here with you chatting about this. Look, the book itself, Foreign Agents, you know, it's out on bookshelves now. It's about a relatively simple topic, and that is the American foreign lobbying industry. These are the Americans. These are the American figures, the American firms, the American networks that work as lobbyists on behalf of foreign governments, foreign oligarchs, foreign proxies, foreign organizations that act as their effective mouthpieces, or if you'd like, foot soldiers in Washington, D.C., lobbying for, pushing for policies that benefit their clients, policies that benefit these regimes, these governments, and so on and so forth. This is not another book about espionage. This is not another book about spies. There are plenty of incredible books that are out there, and I'm sure there'll be plenty of phenomenal books that come out in the years to come, but the reason that I wrote this book is because there had been an absolute dearth of attention paid to, of interest in, and then obviously beyond that, books about the foreign lobbying industry, even though this is now a multi-billion dollar industry that almost every single government, maybe this side of North Korea, engages in, which is a shame that you and I can't talk about Kim's lobbying efforts in Washington. At last check, I didn't see any PR firms or necessarily law firms that were working for him, although, of course, that could change moving forward. The name of the book itself, Foreign Agents, comes from the single piece of legislation surrounding this, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which you and I might be talking about more in the coming conversation. But this is really what the book is about. Where did this industry begin? How has it grown in recent years? And then, as you said a moment ago, how is it that foreign governments are able to reach into the American legislative and policymaking process, especially as it pertains to American foreign policy and even broader strategic decision making, to influence the outcomes really without any kind of attention being paid to it, let alone concern, let alone policy responses thereafter?
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit for the benefit of our listeners about FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which you referenced. And, you know, there's been a few high profile indictments coming out recently from the DOJ that our listeners may be aware of. But what exactly is FARA, and you know, what kinds of activities does it prohibit or govern, and, you know, who should be declaring themselves under FARA that doesn't declare themselves?
Sure. So the Foreign Agents Registration Act, or FARA, as again, I'm sure this is especially a Washington audience, so they'll be used to acronyms at this point. FARA was first introduced, first passed in 1938. All right. So almost you know, almost a century ago at this point. And as the book details, this was a direct outgrowth of concerns around and congressional hearings and investigations into how foreign regimes, and most especially foreign totalitarian regimes, were targeting, were influencing, and were swaying Americans. There's one figure in particular that much of the book focuses on early on, a gentleman named Ivy Lee, who, if folks are familiar with him, he's still considered the father of the public relations industry. He worked with almost everyone who was anyone, or anyone who was everyone, in the United States of America in the early 20th century, really creating the PR industry as we know it. He invented the first press release. He really created the crisis management playbook, worked with politicians, worked with businessmen, so on and so forth. And then by the 1920s, he realized he could go abroad and work with many more clients who were willing to pay just as much, if not more, money. So he shows up in Rome, and he ends up working with Benito Mussolini and this new thing called a fascist regime. He shows up in Moscow and ends up working with the Soviets, who are trying to gain American recognition. He's advising the Soviets on how to do that. And then most notoriously, he shows up in Berlin and ends up working for the Nazis and advising Joseph Goebbels and Adolf Hitler and, you know, the highest ranks of the Nazis about how to target and identify potential American audiences and how to whitewash their regime. So anyways, this is all a way of saying when this all came out, it was an absolute bombshell. Congressional legislators never expected it. The American public never anticipated it. And in response, they passed legislation called the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which is an extremely simple piece of legislation. It's very progressive. It's very pro-transparency. Even a century later, it's still one of the most progressive pro-transparency pieces of legislation globally in terms of looking at foreign lobbying. But basically what it does is it doesn't ban any foreign lobbying. There are all these constitutional protections that you and I can get into later if you want to, but it doesn't make any of this illegal. But it does require that these foreign lobbyists, who are, again, Americans who work at things like PR shops or lobbying shops or law firms or consultancies, so on and so forth, it requires that they disclose what they are doing. It requires them to disclose who they are working with. It requires them to disclose how much money they are making. And it requires them to disclose, again, how they are targeting the American populace as well as American legislators on behalf of their foreign clients. All this information is supposed to be disclosed with the Department of Justice, which will then publish it for the American public, the American populace. And now in the 21st century, anyone with a computer in the U.S. or elsewhere can go to the Department of Justice website. They can look through all of these filings. They can look through all of these FARA disclosures and look at what any country is doing with any firm right here in the United States of America. I will say, maybe a little bit of a spoiler for the book, is for as progressive and as welcome as that piece of legislation was, Americans just kind of ignored it for about 75 years thereafter, and it really wasn't worth the paper that it was written on, unfortunately, which is, again, one of the reasons that this industry blossomed and bloomed to what it is now, and why we are very much playing catch-up and trying to unearth and expose some of these networks.
Right. And so, you know, bringing this over to Asia a little bit, you know, I think you'll know from your experience covering the former Soviet space in Central Asia that, you know, there are other countries that have foreign agents laws that are, of course, very different from what FARA tries to do. So, you know, talk a little bit about that, because obviously, you know, I think Russia passed one of those laws in 2012, Kyrgyzstan and Georgia more recently. How are those laws different? And you know, we're in this kind of modern interconnected era now where obviously businesses, consultants kind of flow across borders and try to do shady things, perhaps less shady things in some cases. But, you know, What is the difference between FARA and how those foreign agents laws in some of those other countries work?
Yeah, I will confess I'm not an expert on the technical details of, say, the Kyrgyz laws or the Russian laws, but at the 10,000-foot level, they are broadly similar, at least structurally, right? The rationale for the Russian authorities or the Kyrgyz authorities for implementing this was not a means of necessarily, as they would say, criminalizing these or jailing these networks themselves. But if the Americans can have something like this, why can't we? We simply want to expose what these networks are doing and who is being funded. Now, of course, at the end of the day, these are either authoritarian or budding authoritarian regimes in places like Kyrgyzstan or full-on dictatorships in places like Russia. I have no doubt we will see similar types of legislation in places like Uzbekistan, certainly places like Turkmenistan moving forward, potentially even places like India moving forward, used primarily as a means not of transparency for transparency's sake, or allowing citizens of Kyrgyzstan or Russia or China, what have you, to dig into and trace these networks themselves, but simply as a means of criminalizing dissent, targeting opposition journalists, going after civil society and the like. It's kind of a, and I've been asked this a few times, and I don't have a kind of a more fine-tuned answer. It's kind of a disappointing response because they are structurally similar. But again, this gets into the basic question of a governance model writ large. If you have an authoritarian regime, and again, if you want to extend things out even further, we see this taking place in places like Turkey, places like Hungary as well, where it's these clearly anti-democratic elements see this as an opportunity, as an opening to use something that in the American side has been a wonderful boon for transparency to use it for the regime's sake themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's also a massive onerous bureaucratic requirement for civil society organizations, right, in a way that creates just a more hostile environment for these activities to be carried out, whereas Farah, as you said, is simple, is mostly about transparency. But, you know, I mean, what exact kind of activities does it cover, right? I mean, is Farah primarily concerned with foreign governments trying to interfere in American democracy, advocating for legislature, trying to influence politicians? Or is it even concerned with, you know, just people doing, you know, research, consulting, or analysis for kind of foreign clients? What is the exact scope? And are there certain, like, gray areas in Farah?
Sure. Well, there are certainly gray areas, which we can absolutely talk about moving forward. And that gets into some of the legal questions, especially about some of the recent prosecutions we have seen, the recent indictments we have seen. More at its broadest, there are kind of two big buckets that Farah is trying to focus on that is requiring these foreign lobbyists to register and disclose their work. One you just mentioned a moment ago, and that is actually organizing advocacy on the ground in terms of meetings, in terms of legislative pushes, in terms of encouragement or discouragement for specific policy creation or policy responses in Washington. Typically in Congress, sometimes with the White House, but broadly with the Washington policymaking establishment. And again, this is a direct outgrowth of what domestic lobbying in the United States of America has looked like for, frankly, almost since the very beginning of the American Republic. If you go all the way back to the 1790s, and this was one of the most fun parts of putting the book together, is this kind of historic research. You can find veterans of the Revolutionary War lobbying the Washington administration, the very first presidential administration, for back pay. It's these simple kind of basic mechanisms for what is lobbying, how does lobbying work, how does lobbying operate that we have seen in the domestic context that these American firms, these American figures are now using, are now operating upon, and are now building out for foreign clients behind them who are paying them. So that's one big bucket that is targeting the legislators themselves for specific policy decisions and policy outcomes. The other big bucket is targeting the American populace. And that is generally things like, and this is not an exhaustive list, but things like media campaigns, going to journalists, going to editors, saying you should cover this story or not that story. Here are some talking points. Oh, by the way, we're organizing a trip to come to X country or Y country so you can see on the ground and do some reporting there. This is holding things like events or conferences or public meetings that the public can come to and learn more about X country or Y country, whatever it may be. This is maybe at the broadest level, reputation management, one of the academic terms is image laundering. It is generally associated with authoritarian regimes, though by no means. It certainly bleeds into concepts like soft power as well. So you have all these kind of intellectual academic debates along the way. But that's generally the second big bucket that we're talking about, is targeting not the legislators themselves, but the American populace. Maybe sometimes with the theory that the populace will then pressure legislators to pursue certain policies, although that doesn't necessarily translate.
Yeah, so no, that's super helpful for our listeners, because I was going to say, I mean, back when I was more directly involved with editorial operations at The Diplomat, this was something we had to be very vigilant to, because we would get these kinds of submissions from, you know, certain PR firms, and it was very clear that, you know, this was not a genuine effort by an author to represent an argument. And, you know, this is something that we talk about a lot among journalists and editors, because you do have to be vigilant, because you don't want to end up publishing something that just turns out is a cutout for some regime trying to whitewash its reputation. Obviously, very, very murky sometimes, because people do obscure their true intentions, who they might be working for. And so, yeah, huge headache.
I was going to say, look, you're exactly right. That is a position I do not envy you being in. And certainly I, as a journalist, have been on the receiving end of requests from foreign lobbyists themselves. It's not quite Asia, but my initial experience in this space was with Azerbaijan, a woman who just a few weeks ago pleaded guilty to violating FARA. This was years before that, came to me and asked if I would like to be flown to Azerbaijan on a congressional junket and put up in a lovely hotel. All my costs are paid for. The only thing they ask is that I don't write anything negative about the government and the regime in Azerbaijan. And unfortunately, I had to decline. And unfortunately, as folks will see in the book, that ended up blowing up into the biggest congressional scandal in terms of foreign lobbying through the entire 2010s. I will say, though, okay, it is worth emphasizing that it's not just the authoritarian regimes that do this. It is, you know, for the sake of the conversation today, is worth highlighting that many countries around the world, democratic or otherwise, or authoritarian or otherwise, engage in this. And I'm reminded of the, and I don't know if you had a chance to look through this, the indictment against Sumi Terry, the one of the U.S.'s leading Korea experts, both South Korea and North Korea. One of the elements of her indictment was the allegation, and of course she's innocent until proven guilty, but the allegation that she was accepting funds directly from the South Korean government, some of which resulted in her writing an article in Foreign Affairs, right? One of the flagship magazines steering American foreign policy, and that she did not disclose those payments to her editors, to her readers, to whomever it might be. And again, that's just one of many allegations in the indictment, but I think it really kind of hits home what you were just talking about as a on the journalistic side of things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when it comes to prosecutions and how often people actually do get successfully prosecuted and convicted of FARA violations, I mean, DOJ has had a bit of a checkered record. I mean, is the burden of proof for prosecutors under FARA, is that kind of tougher than it should be? I mean, what have you kind of come across in your research for the book?
So that's a great point. It's absolutely checkered. The book goes into the history of some of these recent prosecutions. And again, this is really only since 2016 or 2017 or so when DOJ started enforcing some of these, and certainly some of the prosecutions.
Thanks to Paul Manafort, right? I mean, huge.
Yes. thanks to our old friend Paul Manafort, who, did some work in Asia, as I recall. He was Ferdinand Marcos's go-to man during the final days of the Marcos regime in the Philippines, which was... Yes, as horrible as it sounds. There were some successful prosecutions in the late 2010s, and there were some less successful prosecutions in the early 2020s. Some of those less successful prosecutions in which the parties accused were acquitted. Some of those were juries finding in favor of those accused parties. One of those, Steve Wynn, the former Republican National Committee he was a fundraising chair who was accused of acting as a foreign agent on behalf of China, on behalf of the CCP. The judge ruled in his favor because of statute of limitations concerns. In the ruling, the judge said effectively, yes, this was a prosecution that had been filed promptly and within a certain time frame, he would have likely been found guilty. But because of statute of limitations, that wasn't possible. So, yes, you're exactly right that it has been checkered recently. Now, what we have seen, and you and I are talking here, what it is, middle of September here in 2024, you and I are talking in the immediate aftermath, really in the last month or 6 weeks or so, of kind of an unprecedented flurry for this time frame of convictions and prosecutions related to foreign agents and foreign lobbying related crimes. Most spectacularly, now former Senator Bob Menendez was, for the very first time in American history, a member of Congress found guilty of conspiring to act as a foreign agent. In his case, among other things, accused of accepting gold bars and then Googling how much is a gold bar worth on behalf of the government in Cairo. We had, of course, the Sumi Terry case out of South Korea. We had also spectacularly just a few days ago the indictment out of New York State, where the former top aide to the governor in New York State was accused of acting as an agent of the CCP. There were allegations and accusations out of Russia, you know, so on and so forth. It's been difficult to keep on top of for someone like me who's in the middle of, you know, book promotion. It's wonderful timing, but I don't have a lot of time to read through these indictments. But it has been remarkable to see.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, just in closing, Casey, I mean, you know, for our listeners, this has, I think, been a really fascinating insight into this murky world. And I hope, you know, people will pick up the book to really dig into the cases that you unearth and tell the stories of. But, you know, just in closing, I wanted to ask you, I mean, what impact does all of this have on the world of geopolitics more broadly, right? I think your book focuses on the United States rather rightly. I mean, the U.S. being the most powerful country in the world with allies and adversaries all over the place, people have an interest in trying to influence this country. And it is an open society, which creates certain vulnerabilities that FARA attempts to address. But at the end of the day, I mean, how much of what happens in our world and how states sort of interact with each other, how policy is made, do you think is being affected by this? And as a consequence, I mean, do you think we're potentially heading heading into a period where these types of influences will be something that governments take more seriously. I mean, just given all of the stuff we talk about also with disinformation and how open societies are just vulnerable to external influences of all kinds, what is kind of the bottom line here?
Well, to the latter question, yes, absolutely. I do think governments in Washington and elsewhere will continue to take this seriously. Just in the past few years, we have seen Australia implement its own version of FARA. Much of that was aimed at, or continues to be aimed at, concerns about Chinese influence operations. We see discussions ongoing in places like Canada, places like the United Kingdom. Again, these are just democratic allies of the U.S. I have no doubt we'll also see authoritarian regimes pass their own versions of FARA or foreign lobbying related legislation, and then of course prosecutions thereafter. You know, I'm not going to sit here and argue that this is the single most important factor in geopolitics in the 21st century, but what I would argue is that this has been an overlooked element of the policymaking apparatus, policymaking decisions for years and years, and frankly continues to be, even though obviously we have a book, we have a number of prosecutions about this. I would love to see far more attention, far more concern, far more consideration surrounding this. I suspect we'll see far more prosecutions surrounding this moving forward. And, you know, again, the good news, the silver lining, I suppose, is even though there can be more, that there's more that should be done, we have seen a remarkable uptick in terms of filings, in terms of transparency, and in terms of folks who are willing to disclose and divulge what they are doing and who they are doing it for in terms of foreign governments. And we do have more concern in Washington about some of these networks. You know, it's going to take years to disentangle some of these. It's going to take generations to go back through archival work to look at how some of these networks led to specific policy outcomes. Of course, we're trying to follow this in real time, whether it's with the filings or with the indictments, so on and so forth. It's constantly moving target. But what I would say is, if it is not the most important piece of geopolitical discussions or tensions or developments, it is one that I hope folks will pay more attention to, both now and moving forward.
All right. Well, Casey, we'll close it there for today, but thanks so much for coming on the show. For listeners, again, the book is Foreign Agents, How American Lobbyists and Lawmakers Threaten Democracy Around the World by Casey Michel, sold wherever fine books are sold. So go out and get yourself a copy. Casey, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ankit.
For listeners, make sure you subscribe so you can keep up with future episodes of the podcast. And if you've been a subscriber for a while, but you haven't yet left us a review, please do so. It really helps the show out. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll be back soon with more at the Asia Geopolitics Podcast.